Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Richard Lear, Sports Radio 101.9 FM and Sports Radio 66 WFAN.
And we are back. We've got Peter Hoffman at the controls. Richard Neer till 3 o'clock. Coming up at 3 o'clock, Chris Moore. Paul Dottino joins us about an hour from now. But right now, we're going to do a little backwards. Let's go backwards when forward fails. To the thrilling days of yesteryear, 1987, when I started a program called The Sports Connection along with Rick Cerrone, who was originally brought on as a producer and kind of drifted into a whole co-host role in that show, and was always great to banter back and forth with Rick with his extensive baseball knowledge. And Rick has done many, many things since then, including working with the Pittsburgh Pirates and a long stint with the New York Yankees as their head of PR, although he had a much more extensive title than that. And currently he is the editor of Baseball Digest, which is one of the longest running baseball magazines around. And Rick, now that I got you, tell me about the current issue, or the one that's about to come out.
Well, it's, as we say, it's headed to newsstands and subscribers. And good afternoon, Richard. Great to be back with you again. And I think we've got a fascinating cover. Jacob deGrom, Anthony Rizzo, and Marcus Semien in a cover feature called Left Out. These players were all drafted after the fifth round. And as you know, this year's draft was dramatically reduced to only five rounds. So we kind of look at a number of players that were drafted after round five. Now, I don't think the draft will stay at five rounds, but it's certainly not going to 40. And we talk about what are the ramifications of, you know, a whole slew of young athletes not being drafted by major league teams.
Well, that's interesting. And also what's interesting, Rick, and I'm sure you have either had these discussions with your baseball friends or thought about this yourself, the trading deadline is coming up in about 2 weeks. And with a 60-game season and 16 teams in Major League Baseball making the playoffs, do you think there's going to be a lot of trades, or do you think there'd be almost no trades?
Well, I'm going to defer to my friend and colleague Joel Sherman in the Post, I believe today, who wrote a terrific piece. He talked to a number of general managers, and only one of them thought there would be a lot of trades. And, you know, one of the reasons given was that you might trade for a player who decides, I'm not going, I'm going to opt out, because he has that option. So I do think when you look at the teams and where they are, and Richard, there are a lot of surprises. Which ones of those teams are going to say, hey, we've got a shot here? I think there are teams. I don't think the Marlins, the Orioles, both real surprises, I don't think they're going to make major trades, the Tigers. But I do think there's teams that are in the mix that are going to deal. So I think we're going to see some activity.
I wonder how much, in the sense that, let's say you're a team that thinks, well, I could put myself over the top with a particular pitcher or a particular hitter, but I'm going to lose them at the end of the year, or they're, you know, maybe only signed for one more year. But then you're looking at prospects, and there was no minor league baseball this year.
Right.
So you're going on 2019 numbers, and You don't know what that guy has done this year, if he's progressed, if he's regressed. You know, you're kind of going a little bit blind in terms of prospects that you're getting. So it makes it a lot more tough to evaluate trades and, you know, risk reward and all of that.
Yeah. Another thing I'll point out, though, that the way this crazy year has been laid out. So let's just say the Yankees or the Oakland Athletics or the Minnesota Twins all leading their divisions. But let's focus on the Yankees. The Yankees blitz through this season. You know, they're 35-25, 40-20. They win their division by 8-10 games. And like everyone else, they're in a three-game series. Now, the Yankees would have those three games at home, but they'd have to win two out of three. And if the season ended today, you've got the Rays, and then you've got tied for the eighth spot, the Astros and the Tigers. So I don't know how that's going to play out. So they're going to have to go in and have a three-game series against the Astros and the Tigers. There may be a team, maybe it's the White Sox, maybe it's the Angels, somebody who kind of sneaks in to that eighth spot that says, to get through that three-game series and move on, we're going to need another pitcher. So I think that may be a possibility. But that brings out the whole craziness of the season where we've created a situation where the best team in baseball's got to go through another level, another round, another hurdle to get to the World Series.
And a short hurdle, a three-game series where you know anything can happen in 3 days. I mean, you would think, okay, you got Gerrit Cole going, how are you going to lose? But you lose 2-1, 1-0, a bad hop, a hanging slider. Anything like that could determine your season in such a short series.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things I'm fascinated by is that, and I realize this is a very different season, and I'm all for anything they can do to make it more interesting. This is great. Now, moving forward, would I want to see this? Absolutely not. But there's a whole faction of so-called experts that, you know, they want change for change's sake. They're never happy. You know, when we went to the two wild cards and they played one game, no, that's not fair. The wild card should play the team with the best record, and all the games are in the other park, and they have to win two games in a three game, and the other team has to win one game. This is silliness. So let's get through this year. I think baseball is doing a tremendous job in navigating this uncharted territory. I like what they've done. Some of the things I think I'm all for staying, even though I'm a traditionalist, but some of the things we just need to go kind of closer to back the way it was.
Unfortunately, Rick, I think they've opened the barn door.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, once you start, you know, breaking the rules, and, you know, not breaking rules, but expanding
right.
things, seven-inning doubleheaders, you know, the playoff system that it is, the DH in the National League, all of this stuff. The horse is out of the barn, and people say, well, yeah, it wasn't so bad. Well, you know, all right, we already did it. There's precedent. Once you've set precedent, people will be more open to just keeping it.
I think it's very easy to keep what you've already put out there once you've opened the door. But I do think baseball is going to take a look at each of them individually and say, what worked well. Look, a couple years back, they went to the automatic four-pitch intentional walk, which I don't really see a reason for, but they did it. They liked it. It stuck. I think they put this three-batter minimum rule in prior to this abbreviated season, so that was a standalone as it was. I have no problem with that. I think that if you're a major league pitcher, you should be able to, you know, I think the specialist was abused. Managers were abusing it. And sometimes you've got to do things to kind of like make up for abuses. And this was one. The other thing is the runner at second base in extra innings. You know what? I'm a traditionalist, but I kind of really like this. I mean, I watched the Angels and the Dodgers last night, and in the Dodgers, in the top of the inning, runner at second base stole third. They had the shift on. He was a little bit away from third base. Rendon stole third, scored on a sacrifice fly. Angels came up in the bottom of the inning, swung for the fences, three up and three down. It kind of creates some excitement right off the bat where extra innings did not traditionally do that.
Now, I should be fair. Rick and I talked a couple of days ago off the air, and Rick said, and I tend to agree with him, that, you know, the runner on second base is kind of cool, but we don't want it in the 10th inning. And I think you said, well, I'd like it in the 12th, but I'd settle for 11. And I think maybe 11 is good. You know, you have one inning where you just play by the normal way, and then you say, okay, we don't want 18 inning games where nobody's scoring and guys are trying to hit home runs to break it open. Let's try it from 11 on, and I think that might work.
You know, 18 inning games are an oddity. I've been through many of them with the Yankees. I remember one at Yankee Stadium in, I think, 1997 or 98, where it was the second game of a twilight doubleheader that went 18 or so innings. We played one in Toronto. You know, it's just a war of attrition. And the next day, your team is decimated. You know, players get sent down to the minors. They lose their jobs. Some of them never come back. So I get it. I have no problem with this rule to some degree. Yes, I would say the 12th. I don't think MLB will go for that because I think they really like it. So I'll say play the 10th inning traditionally and then move on to this new rule in the 11th inning.
Now, do they need the Players Association to approve that for next year, or can they just do that unilaterally?
You know what? I'm not sure. I've got to plead ignorance on that, which I do very often. You know, they were able to put through the three-batter minimum rule, so I don't see why they couldn't do this. But, you know, like you and I were saying on the phone earlier this week, as I said, you know, Yankees score three runs in the bottom of the ninth, and everybody's going crazy. They tie the game up at 5-5 against the Blue Jays. Well, the Blue Jays come to bat in the top of the 10th, let's say at Yankee Stadium, and everybody's sitting on their hands, or they're on their phones or whatnot. Mm-hmm. They're waiting for something to happen. Okay, well, here's something's happened. You've got a leadoff double, or however the runner, you know, in your mind, got to second base. You automatically have action. And that's the way I find myself watching these extra inning games. I find myself looking forward to an extra inning game. And I don't think, you know, you really did that in the past.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. And, you know, I guess as we get older, especially with the games going on at night, you start falling asleep and you miss the end of the games anyway, or you wake up and, fell asleep in the 12th inning. It's now 16th. What happened?
Exactly. Well, listen, I'll tell you one other thing, though, and we talked a little bit about this. The 7-inning games for doubleheaders are perfect for this season when you have to play so many doubleheaders. But what I would say to baseball is, look, there is no reason for 7-inning games in doubleheaders because, number one, teams play so few straight doubleheaders. There's no reason to play a split doubleheader, and you're charging split admission. You can't charge full price admission, which you do for a day-night doubleheader, and then play 7 innings. Well, so let's discount that. You don't. How many straight doubleheaders do you really play? And that's something where the outcome is really impacted. You cannot tell me that there's not a difference in the competitive aspect of a 7-inning game and a 9-inning game because, hey, 5-4 after 7, you win. Oh, that team could have won, you know, 11-5 if the game went 9 innings. I mean, there was a game the other night. The Oakland A's trailed the San Francisco Giants by 5 runs in the top of the ninth and won. Well, that's a doubleheader. They lose that game. So I'm okay with some of these new rules, but I think they have to be looked at, and I just like to see common sense prevail.
Yeah, well, one thing I don't like, and I'm in a big minority here, but I hate the shift. I really do. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've seen these hard hit balls up the middle, and I go, oh, there's a hit, and the run's going to score. And the second baseman or the shortstop is standing right behind the second base bag, makes a play, steps on the bag. It's a double play, and the inning is over. So I favor the traditional two guys on one side of second base, two guys on the other. But, you know, everybody says, oh, the strategy, and at least this year, I'm starting to see, I don't know if you've noticed it too, guys trying to bunt and trying to go the other way a little bit more, even with little weak grounders that they can beat out.
Well, I've got to be honest with you that over the years, I've been shocked that more players have not tried to beat the shift, to hit the ball the other way, to bunt, to get the defense to play a more traditional defense against you. You know, I don't think I'm in favor of legislating against the shift, but I wouldn't be, you know, radically opposed to it. But I think you are starting to see teams try to beat the shift, but other than by just hitting the ball through it. You remember, you know, the famous Wee Willie Keeler, hit him where they aim.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You know, that's completely gone away. I mean, it's a different game today. It's a different game. Every batter is basically going up there and doing the same thing, swinging with that, you know, that launch angle. And, you know, I think the game will evolve, but there's still a tremendous amount of strikeouts. Though I will tell you, Richard, I was really surprised to see how far down in the leaders the Yankees are in strikeouts. The Yankees really seem to have cut down on the strikeouts because, you know, they're having their typical Yankee season. They're playing great. They're overcoming injuries. They're getting their share of injuries like they always do. They're playing great ball, and then they're going to get into the playoffs. They're going to face good pitching, and this one-trick pony doesn't work. But I think this year I'm starting to see a little bit more put the ball in play by most of their players. So we'll have to see what happens.
Yeah, well, I'll let you weigh in on what people have been calling about all day, and that is, why are these guys getting hurt so much? You know, geez, Aaron Judge and Stanton, you know, it's always something with their legs or something's going wrong with them. What's your theory on why there seem to be more injuries these days?
Well, I really think you have to throw this season out because this was such an untraditional, if that's a word, you know, season, right, where everybody went to spring training, and then on March 13th, they just shut it down. And some teams stuck around, and for another week or two, they worked out, and then they all went home. And then they're working out in their yards, in their living rooms. Then they're ramping it up again for 3 weeks. And as I said, when this thing started back in early July, that some teams are going to take this much more seriously than others and are going to be much more proficient at running a 3 week summer camp than others. And you're going to see that in the first 30 days of the season. And that's where we are now. There's going to be teams that start 10-3. There's going to be teams that start 3-10. And a lot of it's going to have to do with how they prepared for this season. So I just think that you really have to look at this as an absolute aberration. I mean, look, I don't know why Giancarlo Stanton, you know, pulls a hamstring or Aaron Judge has tightness in a calf. There could be a dozen different reasons. There could be a dozen different reasons. You know, it's impossible to nail it down. I mean, DJ LeMahieu gets hurt swinging the bat. It's just one of those things.
Yeah, it just seems it's more one of those things these days than back in the past when guys would rub some dirt on it and went back out again. And I'm not saying that these guys aren't as tough as those guys, but I don't know. You know, we've talked about weightlifting and all that kind of stuff and what that might do to the injury thing. Well, you brought up the Yankees.
Right.
And it just you know, never fails to amaze me. Guys get hurt, somebody else comes in, next guy up, and I'm even wondering, you know, not that Stanton is not a great player when he's healthy, but if you've got a Tauchman or a Frazier in there who is not going to maybe strike out as much, not as many swings and misses, maybe he's not going to hit the kind of home runs that Stanton hits, but they might even be better off sometimes.
Well, it's hard to say that you're better off without a healthy Giancarlo Stanton. But the Yankees need these types of players, and they need for this to happen however it happens. They have to cut down on the strikeouts. So, you know, give Brian Cashman a lot of credit. I mean, look at the players that he's brought in that you could take the greatest baseball fans out there, and nobody was saying, nobody, no writer, no, hey, you know the Yankees should go out and pick up Gio Urshela.
Yeah.
They ought to go
Who's
get
he?
this guy Tauchman in Colorado. You know, he's really terrific. You know, Clint Frazier was a big name, you know, prospect that they got in the trade. You know,
Miller
other people
trade,
saw that coming.
Yeah.
But he's done a fabulous job of building the depth of this team where that they lose a player on a daily basis and they don't miss a beat. But sometimes things happen and you look back and say, you know, we never thought that would be a plus. I'll give you a perfect example. Back in 1977, you know, my group and I went to a Yankee game, and sitting in Keith Olbermann's box seats behind the first base dugout, and we're all excited to see the first appearance of Mike Torres, who the Yankees just acquired from the Oakland A's. Except there's an announcement made there, or put it on the scoreboard, or however, that Torres has not yet reported because there was a complication in his wife's delivery of a baby. Okay, so the Yankees are going to throw this pitcher that was on the roster, Ron Guidry. Now, Guidry was on the roster the year before. He could throw the ball hard. Nobody thought that much. He wasn't an up-and-coming superstar. And we saw an amazing performance. I think he combined with Lyle for a shutout that night. Boom, never left the rotation. So sometimes things have a way of happening, and, you know, you're thankful that they do. So let's see what happens. But the one thing about the Yankees, they're going to need all the depth that they can muster.
Yeah. I mean, throughout the injuries. But I'll tell you, I have that informal bet with Sweeney Murdy they were going to win 110. Obviously, they can't because they're not playing that many games. But proportionally, they're playing 700 ball now, and I don't see a reason they can't sustain it unless they don't try to. And by that, I mean, you know, they just decide, okay, we're going to take our foot off the gas here because we're in the playoffs. We're seeded already, so we don't have to. Do you think that will happen, though? I mean, do you think that they will be managed differently in September, given the fact that there are 16 teams in and the seeds are what they are? Do you think that teams at the last couple of weeks of the season will just say, you know what? You know, it's not going to be a 40-man roster where you throw in kids, but they'll play differently?
Well, there'll be teams that can't do that because they have to play themselves into that top eight. So there's going to be a whole bunch of teams that are playing every day like they're in a pennant race. Now, the Yankees are a little bit different because they're likely going to finish first, certainly not going to finish worse than second. So they may be more on a maintenance program at some point because they do that anyway. You know, they'll rest guys. They'll, you know, guys on the Yankees don't really play every single day. Guys get their rest, get their, we call it maintenance, whatever. So I do think the Yankees are going to be, there's no goal they're going to set for. I think obviously you'd like to, you know, finish first and be pitted against the eighth seed, so to speak. But they're not looking for a third consecutive 100-win season under Aaron Boone or only the third time in the history of the Yankees they've done such and such. Those bets are all off. So I think the Yankees will do a kind of a combination, but will really have an eye on October and being ready to go.
You brought up something with a shortened season. Now, obviously, home runs, RBI, that's not going to be affected. You're not going to have any records broken there. But the one area that could be threatened, Blackman, last I looked, was hitting over 500. There are some guys over 400. Do you think if a guy hits 400 in 60 games that record stands, or there has to be some kind of notation that it was a short season or what?
Well, first of all, it's not a record. I mean,
well, not a record.
It's not a record. You'd be looking at that as, are we going to say, you know, 40 years from now, will we say the last 400 hitter in the major leagues was DJ LeMahieu in 2020? No, we won't say that because we'll look at it having to be a full season record. So, you know, I don't think he'll be on that list. I think it's like a no hitter in a seven inning game. You know, Elias has dictated, you know, the official statistician, it doesn't count. It's got to be a nine-inning complete game no-hitter. So I think that this season, everybody talks about, will this season have an asterisk like the Mantle home run record, the Maris home run record did? Well, let's not forget that the Maris home run record never had an asterisk. You know, there was never an asterisk. It was separate records. There was a record for a 162-game schedule, Roger Maris 61, and a record for 154 games, Babe Ruth 60. So there was never an asterisk. But when you talk about this season having an asterisk, it may not have an official asterisk. MLB is not going to put an asterisk on its season, but it'll have a mental asterisk.
Yeah,
just like Barry Bonds' 762 home runs and 73 home runs in a season. They have a mental, your own mental asterisk. And that's what this, now, listen, it will create some excitement to see if someone can hit 400. I thought you were going to say, can someone hit 500? Because Blackman was there a couple days ago, but he's fallen off a little bit. So
yeah, I'll look that up during the break, which we're going to do now. And since you brought up Maris, the next guy, Mantle, some thoughts about the late, great Mickey Mantle.
Absolutely.
Coming up next with Rick Cerrone. Stay tuned.
Sports Radio 101.9 FM,
The Fan.
Sports Radio 66 WFAN.
Back with you, Richard Neer on The Fan, along with Rick Cerrone, my old buddy from the Sports Connection days, now the editor of Baseball Digest. And before we get into some Mickey Mantle stuff, Rick, one thing that has been a little stuck in my craw for a while, and especially now with these seven-inning games, you know, we're looking at pitchers now who are going four innings, four-plus innings. The old rule where you had to go five innings to get a win, especially if you're in a seven-inning game, the way managers are yanking pitchers out now and going to the bullpen. And sometimes you will get an instance where a starting pitcher will pitch very effectively. He'll come out. The bullpen won't be so good, but the team will win the game, and the reliever who was in when the winning run scored gets the win. I'd like to see that change where the official scorer has the discretion to give even the starter a win when he doesn't go five innings. What would you say to that?
Well, that's a real interesting thought. I like the idea of a starting pitcher having to go five innings. I would not want to give anybody any more reason why they should allow starters to go less than that. So I don't want, you know, manager X, so to speak, saying, hey, he's got an 8-1 lead and he pitched four innings. Let me get him out of there now. I would not want to see that, but you make a good point. A guy goes four and a third, comes out of the game, and you're released. You still win the game, but maybe four relievers each pitch an inning and don't, you know, distinguish themselves. Not a crazy thought. I would probably opt not to do it. I don't see any reason. I just think that we just seem to have this be enamored with trying to change everything. I'm not sure that's something I would feel needs to be changed.
Okay. Let's move on to the Mick. Now, 1987, I brought up at the beginning of the show, that's when our Sports Connection show began. And Rick left the show at a point to take a big job with the Pittsburgh Pirates. And I think it was summer. I don't know whether it was August or July or maybe even early September when Mickey Mantle's restaurant opened on Central Park South. And they called the radio station. They said, you know, you're doing a sports show, and we're opening the restaurant. We want to get some publicity for it. So would you guys be interested in interviewing Mickey Mantle? Ask me something that, you know, really? You want to know the answer to that? Okay, sure. So I traipsed down. It was a Saturday afternoon. You know, it was a day I was not normally working. Drove into the city, brought my little tape recorder, and sat down and talked to Mickey Mantle. It was supposed to be like a 10 or 15-minute interview. It ran an hour, and he wouldn't let me leave afterwards. He kept hanging, have another drink. Let's talk. And we talked even further to the point where Mickey said, you know, we need to record a commercial for the restaurant. You've got a good recorder. Can we do it? So I said, sure. So he read the copy, and he kind of made fun of the copy a little bit, but it got edited, and it turned out to be the commercial. But I sat there, and I just was like, God, this is Mickey Mantle I'm talking to. And I was actually outside myself looking down at that table in the back of the restaurant, going, here I am talking to Mickey Mantle. Do you remember the first time you met Mickey Mantle?
Wow, that's a great question. Well, it would have had to have been at Yankee Stadium, either an opening day or an old timers day when I had baseball quarterly and then baseball magazine. I got to you know, not know him well or anything, but got to know where he knew my name and would, you know, say hello by name and everything and wave me over to chat or something. But it's funny that, and we were talking about this the other day, that when I used to look at Mickey on old timers days or when he was sitting in that clubhouse, I remember one time particularly, it took him a long time to put the uniform on. He was just sitting in his locker, just watching everyone else. And I kind of felt a sadness. And I looked at him thinking, but that man really misses this. And I think that's what he was doing. He was kind of taking it all in. His mind was going back because, you know, he really missed it. He really loved being a baseball player. That's who he was. And I often sensed sadness in him.
Well, you know, it's interesting in Jane Levy's book, The Last Boy, she talks about years after he retired, where he was filming a commercial and he was swinging a stickball and hitting it out, you know, out of sight. And he said, I finally felt like I was Mickey Mantle again.
Right.
So it seems like Mickey Mantle was a creature outside of himself. He was this shy kid from Commerce, Oklahoma. And then on the baseball field, he became Mickey Mantle, this national icon.
Right. Well, I'll tell you a great story. One year in spring training, I was in the coach's room, and the subject of five hits in a game or five for five came up, and they were pointing out that Mel Stottlemyre, had in his rookie season, in one of his starts, went five for five. And I had happened to mention one of the great days I ever remember at Yankee Stadium was in Mickey's last year, 1968, when he went five for five. And Mel said, Mickey never went five for five while I was on the team. He never went five for five in his last. So we made a bet. And I don't know how I did it, but I got the box score. And the next day I brought in the box score. And Mel looked at me and said, if you tell me I was the starting pitcher, I'm really going to be upset. He goes, I have no record. How could I not remember this? But the reason I'm telling you that story of the 5-for-5 game in 1968, he was no longer Mickey Mantle in 1960. He was batting on that May 30th, going into that game, he was batting .221. He had only had one five-hit game in his career, and it was in 1956, his Triple Crown season. He hadn't had a four-hit game since 1962. But for one brief afternoon, this crippled guy, the beautiful invalid, as Joe Trimble referred to him that day, went five for five, two home runs, two doubles, and a single, I believe. And here's the interesting thing. It was the first game of a doubleheader against the Washington Senators, and the clubhouses were closed between games, and you'd bring out the stars of the game, so to speak. And Mantle would not come out to talk to the media. And only when Lee McPhail, the general manager, interceded and got him to come out, did he kind of come out, and he gave them nothing but one-word answers. Do you ever remember going five for five? No. Did you? You know, this pitcher had struck him out four times like 6 days earlier. Was that on your mind? Yes. Very terse. And when I talked to Jane Levy about it, who wrote that great book, she said that's probably because he knew that he could no longer be that guy. That it reminded him, that game reminded him of what he once was. Here's what she said. It would be something less for him to celebrate than something to mourn, because he would have been so aware of how unlikely it was and how hard it would be to reproduce. This is who I used to be. This is what I used to be able to do. I thought that was just so perfect, you know. He really missed being Mickey Mantle.
And one of the things you mentioned, that this crippled guy, I asked him that during that interview at the Mickey Mantle's, and I said, you know, Mick, do you ever look back and say, gee, you know, look at the surgeries and the training techniques and all the things that they could do now with the knee and arthroscopic and all that? And he said, Do you ever just look back and go, gee, if they had that in my day, I could have played another 3 or 4 years at a very high level. I could have been even better than I was. And he said, you know, they had that stuff, that whole rehab thing back then. I just didn't do it.
Right.
I just he it seemed like he just did it on his natural ability, that he didn't lift weights, that, you know, he got those muscles in the mines, you know, he was a worker, and that's how he got to be so strong. It wasn't from going into a gym and lifting weights or working out or anything. So that's, you know, that's part of that natural ability that he had. And of course, the classic line he uttered, if I knew I was going to live this long, I would have taken better care of myself. Because was his dad like 46 when he died?
Well, here's two things about Mickey Mantle. One, he believed he would die a young man. I mean, he died in his mid-60s, 64, 63. He didn't expect to live that long. But the other thing, and I found this fascinating, there's all kinds of photos that we've always seen of Mickey Mantle after that 51, when we stepped in the drain and everything. Mm-hmm. Mantle leaves the hospital after his surgery. He never had surgery. I mean, he said later, I never had a surgery. It just healed on its own. So now, whether that's true or not, but that's directly from Mickey Mantle. So, you know, things were not, I mean, that would not be the case today. I mean, there's no way that injury would not have been dealt with the proper way today. So you can go back and look it up and whatever, but Mickey Mantle actually said, surgery? What surgery? I never had any surgery on that knee. So, interesting.
Yeah. Well, Mickey, admittedly drank a lot, mm-hmm. and talked about it in the Levy book, and talked about it. You very poetically said he had a great ninth inning when, the liver was shot and he realized he was going to die. And he came back and he basically repented and tried to be a role model and said, hey, look, you may look up to me, but don't do what I did. And he really, there was that whole transplant thing that they went through and all of that. And, he really, lived up to his iconic and heroic status, I think, in that, the last years.
I think there were a lot of years for us kids who grew up. I mean, I grew up as a young kid going to my first game as a Cub Scout in 1963. And sitting in the mezzanine, I remember one game he played left field, and I want to say it was a midweek doubleheader against the Chicago White Sox. And we were screaming his name so loud for so long that he finally took off his cap and like waved it at us, like, okay, no, shut up. But I remember he was playing left field, so I guess we could look that up to see if that ever is true, that Mickey Mantle played left field in that year. But, He was my hero, and then when you'd watch him and see things he did in the 70s and 80s, you know, like he did an interview on the Tomorrow Show with Tom Snyder, and he just wasn't heroic anymore. You know, the whole Boughton book thing, which he was probably the only guy on the Yankees that forgave Boughton, which is another testament to who Mickey Mantle was, but he wasn't heroic anymore. And then this unbelievable news that you have liver disease and you're dying, and he steps up, and I probably stole that from probably Bob Costas, who said he had a great ninth inning, but my God, did he. When he stood there and said, hey, I'm a role model, don't be like me. I mean, and then he went on for organ donations, and organ donations went through the roof when he did that. So, yeah, he died my hero, and he did have a great ninth inning.
Yeah, and you know, in between, there were so many people, and I'm sure, when we were doing the show together, we had people calling, hey, you know, Mickey would just walk right past you. He wouldn't sign an autograph. He'd blow you off and everything. And, the natural inclination you have as a human being to think about that as well, you know, he thinks he's too good to do that. And I think some of the things we've talked about in this conversation hold true, that he was shy. He didn't feel that he deserved the adulation. And he was very, loath to accept compliments. And that was just putting him up on a pedestal that he didn't think he deserved.
I think that's very true. And listen, we're not psychologists. We don't know. I mean, I've known people well, and only to find out that they've suffered from low self-esteem. He might have been that person. But, yeah, he was kind of shy, and I think the drinking in many ways was his liberation, so to speak, out of that shyness. And he was, You know, I think people that knew him would tell you that he wasn't a good drunk. You know, he wasn't a good drinker. He got very mean. And he even admitted that later. But, you know, thank God that he made his amends with people. He did the right thing. I'm so proud that he did that, you know, and I knew his son David and Danny a little bit, and, you know, they were proud of him. Like I go back to saying, you know, nobody ever had a better ninth inning.
You know, a lot of people, and this came up earlier, you know, Madeline Mays, they played in the same era. They played in the same city for a short period of time. They played against each other in the World Series. And most people I've talked to over the years say, well, you know, Mays was the better ball player. I mean, you know, Mickey was the glamour guy and everything, but Mays was a better ball player. But in Jane's book, in Jane Levy's book, she uses modern analytics, and, you know, the numbers do tend to favor Mickey Mantle. I mean, his average season over 162 games, if you take all his games and average them out, 162, he hit 36 home runs, 102 RBI, 298 batting average, and here's the thing, on base percentage, 421, 977 OPS. I mean, these are staggering numbers, and on top of that, 23 doubles, 5 triples, and the number of base on balls he had, 117 average, and that was having some pretty good hitting guys behind him, and his average strikeout year was 115. You look at guys now striking out 200 times and not blinking an eyelash. Incredible numbers.
Well, the other thing you have to remember about Mickey is that for much of his career, he was a debilitated player. And the last 5 years or so, maybe even longer of his career, if you look, he was really a limited, debilitated player. You know, when you said that 298, oh, if Mickey Mantle were on the phone with you right now, that would stop him dead in his tracks, and he would talk about, you know, in an article I wrote for Yankees Magazine on that 5 for 5 day some years ago, you know, Marty Appel was talking about how the statistician came running into the office. This is the weekend that Mickey's going to go under 300 for his career. I mean, they knew it was coming. They knew when it was coming. If he goes 0 for 4 tonight, he's under, you know, and he did, and he never got back up there. If he left after that 5 for 5 game, he would have had a 300 lifetime average. But he didn't, and he was a debilitated player. But even on the last team, guys like Roy White, Bobby Cox have told me he was still the best player on the team.
Well, it doesn't speak well for the team, but you're right. I mean, 1964, he had 99 RBI. He had 111 RBI. I'm sorry. Hit 35 home runs. Then 65, it was 19, 23, 22, 18.
Yep.
The RBIs were down to the 46, 56, 54 in his final year. Bases on balls went down. Strikeouts, still stayed low. But his, you know, the number of games he played were cut down to 108, 144 in his last 2 years. I mean,
yep.
he played through it. He played through it, but was unable to, you know, even plate appearances, over 500 plate appearances in those years when he could barely walk.
Right, and, you know, they moved him to first base in 1967 for the final 2 years. And, he, you know what, he was a serviceable first baseman. Which was, he was on the receiving end of the last triple play. The Yankees went like 30 years without turning a triple play. So it was always in the media guide every year that the Yankees turned a triple play on this day in 1968. It went Dooley Womack to Bobby Cox to Mickey Mantle. I always thought, so Mickey Mantle stayed in like the last time it happened, he was involved in the play. But, listen, he was only 36 when he hung him up.
Yeah,
but he just couldn't do it. We couldn't be Mickey Mantle anymore. And another funny thing is the Yankees asked him, wait till next year. Don't announce it after the season. Let us sell as many season tickets as we can. And so he announced it when spring training started in 1969.
Yeah. And you know, famous stories about him and, you know, winning the MVP and trying to get a raise and, you know, first $100,000 ball player and all that. And you look at the kind of money these guys are making now. And Mickey wound up, you know, doing the commercials. I kind of like Brute. Remember that?
Right. Sure. Or I Want My Maple with Willie Mays.
Yeah. Back in the day. And, even then, I guess they weren't paid what they are paid
God,
now.
No, absolutely not. There's a great article in the Post today by Brian Costello on Joe Namath and Jimmy Walsh's agent and just how he was able to market anything. You know, he was able to monetize anything. Hey, the commissioner's ordered me to shave my Fu Manchu mustache. Can you make a deal for that? And he goes and gets $10,000 from somebody, some shaver to do that. So, you know, it was a different world back then. It was a different world.
You know, and one of the things in that 61, the Billy Crystal movie, a lot of people thought Mantle and Maris didn't get along, you know, that they were competitive and, you know, Maris hit the 61 and Mickey only hit the 54 and, you know, the whole Mel Allen doctor thing that happened that year where he got the pus drained out of it and all of that. But the Billy Crystal thing, and I think realistically said that these guys did get along, that was a media thing.
Oh, yeah, they definitely did. In fact, a good friend of Roger Maris was a man named Julie Isaacson, who I don't really know what Julie did. He was like a labor leader, but he was really close to the Maris family. And he would always tell me that, you know, before the movie was made, because he was a good friend of Joe Torre, so I met him and got to know him in like 96. He would tell me before the movie was ever made that they loved each other. They lived together. They roomed together, you know. And then Billy made the terrific movie 61 in 2001, 20 years ago almost, to tell that story. But I remember, you know, Maris was kind of like stayed away from the Yankees for years. So if Maris left the Yankees before the 67 season or so, he had nothing to do with the Yankees for the next 10 years, and then he retired, and George Steinbrenner brought him back on opening day in, I want to say, 78, because they were world champions, so that would have been the 77 season, and they introduced Mickey Mantle out, and I'm sitting there in the press box, and then Bob Shepard starts to introduce Roger Maris, and the place just goes nuts, and Maris didn't want to come back because he thought he would get booed. And he came back, and the place went nuts. And there was Mantle and Maris together again. They raised the pennant, you know, the championship flag. It was one of the great days I've ever spent at the stadium.
The M&M boys. Okay, Rick, we got to leave it there, but thank you so much. We'll do it again soon. And Baseball Digest on newsstands very, very soon. And we'll talk to you in a little bit.
Look for Jacob DeGrom.
All right. Next, we'll shift gears and talk some football. Paul Dottino on the Giants on The Fan.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.